Welcome to episode 3 of the B2B, the Business Club podcast. This week, we're speaking to Dion Mallon.
Yeah, so I know Dion through Love Brum, met her quite recently, but it seems that we've been on a similar kind of pathway in different circles, really. Obviously, she went to the same primary school as us, which is the first I've ever heard, apart from people that we know. And yeah, she's had quite a varied life in and around sales. And we're hoping to find out more. So, hope you enjoy it.
Enjoy. Welcome to B2B Business Club episode 3. This week our guest is Dion Mallons.
Yay!
Thank you very much for taking time out of your busy schedule.
Hello, thank you very much for inviting me. Truly an honour to be sat here in this stadium.
Yeah, big busy too.
How are you doing, by the way?
Very well. Yeah.
And the club's had better weekend away from that. So obviously you've had a very varied career to date. You do a lot. You're involved with charity, which we'll go over a little bit later. But I was wondering, could we start with the beginning? Take it back to the start of your career. West Midlands Police Force.
Ooh, okay.
So, obvious question, where did that come from? Did you always want to be a police person, a police officer, working law enforcement?
Great question. So, first of all, thank you very much for invited me onto the show. So yeah, my story began in around 1979. Actually, I was aged 5, and my parents were having a play fight on the sofa. They sat there on the sofa, and I was sat on the floor next to them, and they were play fighting. I thought my dad was having a right go at my mom, and I just like police, and just sort of instinctively, I knew that the police could help. And could help me and or my mum in that situation. And I just knew at that moment that I wanted to be a police officer to help people to avoid any kind of trouble they might be in. As it happens, it was just play fighting. They both comforted me. But from that day, really, I just had it in my head that I wanted to be a police officer. So I lived in Alum Rock, inner city Birmingham. And there were police... there was police presence. Bobby's on the beat with their big top hats and blue shirts walking around. I never ever saw them as a threat. I didn't see anything bad or wrong. I just knew, yeah, that would be a good thing. So as I grew older and, growing in areas like Alum Rock, and then we moved to Ward End, which was equally as nice. Mm-hmm. And when you tell people that you want to be a police officer, one being from a sort of black community or black family, and two, from being in the community that you're in, that there's a lot of police presence for the wrong reasons. Mm. It's quite a challenge that people still want to be your friend. But in my head, it was, I already know by that time, probably 10 years, I wanted to be a police officer. I knew that I had to stay out of trouble. I had to get certain grades at school and, just keep my nose clean. And so that's all I was focused on. I didn't care who wanted to be my friend.
Was that quite polarising?
Yeah.
And especially in your teenage years.
Yeah, friends saying, well, if you ever become a copper, I'm not going to speak to you again. And they didn't. They literally stopped speaking to me the day that I joined the police. But I didn't care because, where I grew up, there was a lot of, a lot of these lads were fighting and getting themselves in all kinds of rubbish, trouble, and the odd one to get themselves locked up. And I think some of it was down to misguidance, no fathers in the home. Some of it was down to following other friends that were doing the same kind of things. And then they'd look up to those people if they were older and they'd want to get into the same kind of business trouble as them. And I mean, for one, if I did get myself into trouble, my dad would have whooped my backside pretty severely. But I just knew that we had values that I couldn't be bothered getting involved in any of that. It was just, straight down the line, wouldn't be a copper.
I touched upon it earlier that there's two types of people. There's people that see
policemen driving around and on the beat that feel threatened by that, feel like, and have an anxiety about it. And there's people that are like, okay, well, hello, you're right.
Yeah.
How you doing? And kind of be a bit jolly about it, where Balls of Green, Alan Rock and stuff back in the day, people are trying to be a bit naughty, aren't they?
Yeah.
So they see the police as something that they want to be against as opposed to for. And there's two types of people.
Yeah, it's very true. And if I'm honest with you, some police don't help themselves. And that is a very, very small minority of officers that go into the force, and they just come in with totally the wrong attitude. Sometimes I find, or did find from personal experience, that was because they didn't really know or understand the culture of the areas that they were working. So traditionally, lived in Bromford, for example, you wouldn't ordinarily be placed in the area that you grew up with.
Yeah.
I was. They placed... But actually, I think that helped me because I understood the mindset of some of the people. I understood what it was like to come from those areas. But I remember joining the force. I joined in 93, age 19. And there was a guy that was a rocket scientist. He was upper class family, way outside of the Midlands. He didn't even grow up in Birmingham. And that's not a bad thing. But for him, it wasn't a good thing because he just didn't fit in. He had no... Like, he just couldn't correlate with the people in the area. And I think you need a degree of that. You need to be able to understand what makes people tick, to be able to not necessarily be best friends with them, because you can't, when you're policing, you can't be pally, if you like. You've got to understand that right is right, wrong is wrong. And, you know, it's a shame when you have to lock up your friends because they've done wrong. But once you... like put yourself into that position as somebody outside of the community, it's very, very difficult. Yeah, you do.
Especially if you haven't got the life skills.
Yeah.
It's a life skills thing. We've got growing up, like we said, we was discussing just before, that walking to school at an early age and being able to be kind of streetwise at an early age, to be like, okay, don't talk to them, avoid them, cross over if you see them, da-da-da-da-da. Whereas a guy, I'd imagine, that's coming from that background and out the area, I suppose it's hard to imagine.
Mm-hmm. It's not as black and white, is it, as right, you're either being locked up or you're not being locked up.
Yeah.
You need to ingrain within communities, don't you, for the grey areas of, yeah, you might know people are up to no good, but it's not a case of, right, let's go in heavy-handed, cuffs out. You know, it's got to be a discussion, hasn't that?
Yeah, that has.
And it seems crazy that you would be taking people that have just come out of policing college and put them in areas that they've got no understanding of. Mm. But I
imagine police college, just like, this is the scenario, and then when you get out to the real world, it's like,
it's very different now to how it was when I joined. So when I joined, you had to do 10 weeks in the police training college, which was in Coventry, Knighton for us, and then you do 5 weeks out on the street in the area that you were being posted to. So it's like familiarity between yourself and your future colleagues and then people in the community. Yeah, absolutely. And sort of putting some of that theory into practice. And then you'd go back to write and do your last 5 weeks. And then you do your passing out of your ball. And then that's it. You're out in the community. And, it's very tough, especially as a 19-year-old, as I was, kind of going into, even though I knew the community, going to such an adult job as well, because that's another facet. And you know, I was saying to somebody the other day that actually a lot of police officers are going into the force with trauma, so then they're dealing with their own trauma. They're going in, they're seeing all of this trauma in the police through the work that they do, and they come out severely traumatized because they've never actually dealt with the initial trauma. So there are a whole range of challenges that come with policing. And you know, I went to force with trauma and then had a whole heap of trauma when I was in the force. And
I imagine that you grow up very quickly, even as a 19-year-old, being streetwise and growing up in the community that you do. I imagine from going from that to policing in real terms,
I very imagine it's like, okay, so we're going to start you off on petty pickpockets, and then we're going to go through your first day on the job. You might be having to grapple with
Do you remember what your first kind of culture shock was?
Yes, I do. So I'd done my first 10 weeks in writing. I'd come out, and I think it was the first or second week that I'd come to do my you know, 5 weeks in policing, and there was a call of a, what was the incident now? The incident was of a man injured on the car park of the pub, and I can't remember what the name of the pub is, but it's right by, do you know Stechford, where they used to have the fair, Bob Wilson's fair?
Yeah, Manor
Park. Was it the Manor House? Was it the Manor House pub? There, and we went there, and a guy was lying on the ground. We, like myself and my colleague, were the first to respond, and the guy was lying on the ground, and he was just sort of had all this blood-stained foam coming from it. He'd been shot in his chest, in his torso, and obviously he was gurgling, and he'd been shot in the lung, and all this blood and foam. And what do you do? And like, it's chaos because there are people in and out of the pub. There's obviously been some kind of mad incident where a guy is fighting for his life on the ground. You're trying to administer first aid. You're trying to figure out if the gunman's still there. You're trying to call for backup. It's bananas. And you're 19, 20 years old, and you're thinking, okay. But, you know, by the first 10 weeks, we hadn't really covered murder. We hadn't covered, like, any of that stuff. So it's like, you know, you really are learning on the ground.
Yeah.
And it's a real...
As bad as the area was, you don't really expect murder.
No. Not back then, and not there either.
Yeah.
Later on in my career, murder was, unfortunately, it was very... Yeah, it was quite prevalent.
Yeah.
Where because I moved to work in Aston.
Yeah.
And Neachalls and Witten, there was a lot of gang violence. Right. Yeah, it just went... So I qualified as sergeant, so that's the next rank up. So you start off as a constable. Everybody has to do 2 years probationary to make sure that they're fit and can work on their own. And then you have the opportunity to diversify in terms of the type of work you do and or be qualified in terms of rank. So I qualified up to sergeant, and I acted sergeant, but I didn't fully substantiate in the role because I was given the opportunity to work in intelligence later on. So I did, and it did, you know, it took me a couple of attempts to pass my sergeant's exam. One, because I wanted it, but I didn't want it. It's the mindset. I wanted it, but was I good enough? Did I know enough? All of those things that set it. Yeah, absolutely. So, but yeah, I did. And then actually I was given the opportunity to work in intelligence. So I took that because it was like dead man's shoes. It was a really tiny department. Didn't even know about the department that I worked in. But yeah, it was great. Great experience.
What were your two scrapes?
One was a guy that was drunk, and my sergeant and I escorted him back to his home, say on a Friday night, for example. Oh no, it was a Saturday night, actually. And then we went back to do a check on him on the Sunday morning, and he just went mad. And he was all right at first, and he was in this little bed sitting in Erdington. And then he just went mad. He just went mad in this little space. And there's me and my sergeant, and I'm quite tall. I'm nearly 6 foot. And he was throwing his furniture around. He practically barricaded us in the bed sit. And like, you know, he's like, get us out of the way from me. No, stop. You know, and he just kind of, yeah, it's almost like you have to, like, I had to impose my voice and my stature without ending up in some kind of weird fight.
Right.
Yeah.
And that was just a follow-up welfare visit.
And the other one, I was with my probationer, so I did tutor new constables coming into the force, and bless him, he's such a lovely guy. But he looked 16. He was tall, very slender, and looked 16, and that we were putting a parking ticket on a car that was obstructing the road in Alum Rock, and about 40 guys came and surrounded us and just killed us. And, you know, I'm there and I'm thinking, oh my gosh, you know, what's going on? But we resolved that. But they were getting really antsy. What are you doing this for? What are you doing this for? And you don't deserve a ticket. You know, it's just like, right, you have to talk down. And you just...
That's the difference, I mean, isn't it? Inability to communicate.
Yeah.
When you take a situation that is literally... The torch paper's there, ready to be lit.
Yeah.
Because there's been instances like that, hasn't there, where it has escalated not too long ago. So you have that, just being able to talk to people in that way.
Yeah.
That's massive, isn't it?
It is massive. It is a big, big skill to have. And unfortunately, You know, I've been out of the force for quite some time. It's not so easy to do that now because people recognise that there are hardly any police on the ground. Police are stretched to the max. There's no staff. There's no real backup. And so I'm not surprised that communication doesn't happen in the way that perhaps it could or should.
People take advantage of it, aren't
they? Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
From 2015 then, you've decided to step away and pursue a new direction of career. We talk about on here the little voice or the instinct or the burn that tells you, this isn't for me, I want to do something else. How did that sound or feel for you when you decided that you were going to take a change of direction of career and step away from the
force? Wow. So it was a bit of a long sort of road to that. Because it was, you know, I'd wanted to join the force as a little girl. And when I joined in 1993, the week that I joined, my mum had always been ill since I was about nine. And I had, you know, two siblings who were much younger than me. So there's 7 years between myself and my sister and 9 years between myself and my brother. And my dad was there, but he wasn't really there. And but she was always ill. So I was kind of the person putting charge of looking after the siblings and my mum, really. And the week that I joined in 1993, in October, she'd been treated for something for the past sort of the previous 6 years. And actually, she was diagnosed with terminal cancer. So when I talk about going into the force with trauma, I had that hanging over my head. Yeah, it was just like, right, you know, actually, this thing that we've been treating you for, it's not that. Is cancer and you've got 6 weeks to live. So it was a big shock. And of course, I'm in the process of starting being signed up to the police. And, you know, we took the decision that I was going to still continue. I'd already left home by that point anyway, but it was a real tough time. I didn't feel like I could talk to anybody about it, you know. And so, you know, she got through those 6 weeks. You know, she lasted another 7 years, but there was a lot of chemo. There's 3 rounds of chemo. There was lots of, you know, taking care of her. And sort of later on, her and my dad sort of split up. And you know, she was such a fighter. She's such a brave one. But then in 2000, she died unexpectedly on a plane. On her way 30,000 feet in the air to Jamaica. So she was going back to visit her father. And I had a phone call at 2:30 in the morning to say, like from my younger sister, say, Dion, it's mom, she's dead. So there was all of this crazy, don't know how to deal with it. I was in a, you know, relationship that was abusive. I had a one-year-old son and I was a detective at this point. Dealing with some pretty gruesome stuff. So, and then I'm having to try and find my mum where she'd been taken to and then relocate her, repatriate her back to the UK. So the reason why I actually mentioned that is because during the 2 weeks that it took me to get her body back from America, they diverted the plane to Miami-Dade. They did the autopsy, et cetera, and then we had to sort of fly her back. The whole 2 weeks was, when are you coming back? We're really sorry to hear about your mum, but when are you coming back to work? And I'm in this relationship that I'm hating and I've got a one-year-old child and it was just so much, but I never dealt with it because it was, right, you're head of the family now. You've got to sort it out. So I'm the head of the family.
Why?
Wife, mother.
Everything else.
Did it, yeah. And it was just, so that was the very start of this sort of chain of events. And so I think it was about a year or so. Yeah, it was about a year after. So 2001, I took a couple of months out and started to think maybe there's something more I could be doing in my life. So it was in a general sense. And then I went back to work. And then I took a career break for about 16 months. And that was in, I think it was 2000. Didn't get my years right now. I think it's 2003. Yeah, 2003. So by this point, I'd split up from this my husband, as he was at the time. And I just started to look at other things I could do. But more so, it was just trying to get a bit of a breather. I just felt like I felt suffocated by the work that I was doing. Even though I loved policing, I just started to feel suffocated by it. And I didn't realise, actually, I wasn't dealing with the trauma that that I'd had leading up to going to the police, and then my mum dying very suddenly. And so I went back into the police in 2005, had the best years of my life. It was so good, because that's when I worked with a couple of guys called Eddie and Boo, and I'd gone back in. You had to do a year back in uniform, but there was this big job that came in, and I was the only detective in this uniform role that could have managed to deal with that. So I sort of led the guys, and it was really quite time intensive, but we had the most fun.
Yeah.
And then I moved. I was sort of headhunted from there to this intelligence department, and had a really great time. But the department was really small, and then with some of the supervision and supervisory decisions that were made, stress levels started to raise amongst everybody on the crew. Some bad decisions were made, and you just kind of then started to get into the mindset. Is this right? It can't be right that I'm working 21 hours in a row. It can't be right that I'm working 26 hours and then being asked to go to court. It just wasn't right. It just wasn't right. I was burning out big time. And then I have a problem with sleep occasionally. And what happened over sort of the 4-year period, I was surviving on 2, 3, 4 hours sleep. By this time, I'd had another child. And it was just, I talk about it now and I think, how did I get through that?
Yeah.
But I wasn't getting through it.
Yeah.
I wasn't getting through it.
But even back then, mental health wasn't like it is today.
So no, it wasn't.
You just like, oh, crack on your side.
Yeah.
All right, yeah, when you're back.
Yeah, exactly. It's
that, yeah.
Exactly.
It's that, isn't it? That whole thing, we're really sorry, but when are you back?
Yeah, for sure.
And then anything after that, rather than just, we're really sorry, is there anything we can do?
Yeah,
it's
prevalent
now, isn't it? To be like, okay, look after your mental health first. And
yeah, for sure. So what happened then was a series of the sleep deprivation, hallucinations. I was like, seeing my mum in the coffin, all of these weird, vivid, underperforming at work. Has an impact, and then it just, I've dealt with this, so I was lead case builder in quite a large sort of drugs job as part of this intelligence. There's some really great work in the community, but it just became, I just knew I wasn't the Dion that I knew that had, you know, walked into the police, a little bit, a bit traumatised, but could actually cope with stuff. And, I remember going away on holiday in the August, I think it was 2013, and having just me and the children, and I went diving. I'd never been diving in my life. I'm not a great swimmer, but we were in Egypt, and the guy said, come on, you know, come on the boat, come snorkeling. I'm thinking, oh gosh, and the kids they weren't really interested. But I said, come on, let's go and try this. So I tried a bit of snorkeling, and they said, oh, why don't you come diving? And I thought, diving? You're joking, man. I can't even, like, keep my head above water. But and I kid you not, it was like a moment of clarity when you are underwater and you've got just a tank on your back giving you the oxygen, or else you're dead, pretty much. But the beauty under that sea in the ocean was just... I almost can't describe it, because it just gave me that clear thinking, because it was just me, under the sea. Sound like Ariel now, don't I? But me under the sea, and just nothing to think about other than the octopus that was bobbing up, or
just the calm.
Yeah, the ray that was there, my diving instructor, and it was just the most amazing feeling. And then I went back to work into all the chaos again. But my mindset had started to change, because I knew there was something beyond all that chaos. I knew there was some sense of calm. And so I guess in 2012, 13 was when I really started to think there was something else for me. And I guess that there was a woman that I worked with, and she'd gotten through cancer. And then her husband or partner was diagnosed with cancer, and then he ended up passing away. And she kind of played this out in front of us because we, you know, very tight-knit team. And I just thought, I can't, like, what do I want? What do I love? Because it's not this life. I loved policing. I didn't love the situation in which I had to police. And so it really became clear to me in 2014 that something had to give, and then my birthday was in, when did I leave? So I left in 2015, January of 2015. I was due to go and see a friend, go meet them for coffee at the end of January for my birthday, and I couldn't leave the house. Just had a total breakdown, just couldn't stop crying. And they were laughing, so like, Dee Dee, you're the strongest person I know. What's up?
That's the only thing so far, right? That's the whole the sign, isn't it? Check on your strong friend.
Absolutely. And I never saw myself.
No one ever asks a strong friend how they are.
Absolutely. And he just couldn't believe it. And he said, okay, I know somebody that can, that perhaps you can talk to. He knew somebody that had used a therapist, basically. Yeah. And I said, yeah, just give me the number. And I paid, I went off sick. Well, I was already off sick, actually, because what had happened is I was, so backtrack a little bit. The year before, 2014, I started to have like brain and like real severe headaches, couldn't see, all the hallucinations, kidney stones, kidney infection. It was just crazy. It was all stress.
It's all stress, right?
Yeah, didn't know. It was all stress. And the doctor was saying, you need to take time out. You need to take, and I'm like, no. And then I had a bit of an argy-bargy with my supervisor at the time because my doctor signed me off again. I was hospitalised again and I went back and he wanted to put me on some crazy plan. And I said, look, you know what? I can't even take this. I need to just go do what my doctor says. And I walked out in the December, and then the January I was due to meet my friend, and that's when I had the breakdown, really. Bit of a breakthrough, I think. And then from the January through to the July, I put myself every single week. I was, in fact, twice a week at first, put myself, paid for private therapy. And Claire was the best thing that ever could have happened to me, at that moment in time, because, you know, she was like, you've got a form of PTSD, it's lots sort of delayed grief. You've got all this trauma. The stuff that happened in your childhood that you'd never dealt with, just kind of buried it, because he's like, keep smiling, Dee Dee, you'll be all right, you know, just focus on your work. And all that stuff just sits down there, and then
until your body decides, no,
yeah,
I'm not doing
it
anymore.
Yeah, he just chucks it up at you.
Did you carry that kind of, from being the mother figure at home, did you carry that into the police force?
It was a load of things.
The person everyone was relying on.
Yeah, for sure.
Lots of aspects.
Yeah, and it's cultural as well. It's not just being a woman. It's, you know, your culture. Because my parents never said to me, you're going to have it hard because you're a woman or you're black. They never said that to me. And so I never grew up with that mindset. But people outside of my family, or maybe my wider extended family, would say, oh, you're going to have it really tough, you know, as a woman. And as much as you think some of that stuff isn't seeping in, it is. And so when I went into the force, you know, I didn't want to tell anybody about my mum's illness. I didn't want to tell anybody about, you know, the struggles I was having in my marriage. I didn't want to say how hard I was having it looking after my children. And so, yeah, there was an element of having to prove yourself as well, because there weren't many, like, women in the force at that point, and there weren't many black women in the force, although I didn't really sort of, that wasn't really my focus, but there just weren't. There just weren't many, you know. And so I didn't know how that would look to other people. So you don't say anything. And I didn't say anything. And so, you know, it was just a very interesting time to go through. And I look back now, and when I have these conversations, and I think, would I have said anything? I think, yeah, actually, I would. Now, knowing what I know now, I would have said something.
Besides, the culture now around mental health is completely different, isn't it?
Yeah.
Say all those things that I didn't want to ask. I didn't want any help with that.
Yeah.
Well, your mind and body aren't stupid, are they?
No.
Yeah, as much as you've got the frontal thoughts of, okay, yeah, I'm fine. Those part moments then. And like you say, your body just starts going, well, I can't deal with all of this.
Yeah.
You need to just
Absolutely.
You calm yourself down.
Well, your body's run by like your subconscious, really. It's like 95% of how you operate comes consciously.
Yeah.
Stuff that you've stored, you haven't even thought about. And it's all like your views of the world and your parents' views, your parents' trauma sit within you, and you kind of develop a sense of who you are through other people and other circumstances. So yeah. When you are going through this trauma and then you're like, okay, I'm over it now. Actually, there's a part of you that maybe thinks you're not good enough, you're not worthy. All of that sits in that subconscious, and it pops up when you're least expecting it. Mm. And that's when all of this PTSD
starts
unravels, yeah.
So 2015, mm-hmm. How did that decision look, and how do you go from the career that you built up to a career in an industry, you know, nothing about? How did that actually transpire?
Right, so 2015, I was going through therapy, getting all fixed. And then the year before, I don't know if you know, when you buy Glastonbury tickets, you have to, it sort of all happens the year before, doesn't it? So I had tickets to go to Glastonbury in July 2015, and I went and was absolutely broken, exhausted. And I went with a friend of mine who's much, much older, and she'd just come through cancer treatment. And we both dragged ourselves to Glastonbury and sat on that top of that hill overlooking, just burst into tears. We were just so sort of relieved but exhausted with life. And part of my hallucinations, I was hearing the Haka, you know, the New Zealand rugby. And one of the first acts that I saw on the... So we landed there the Wednesday. On the Friday, one of the smaller stages with New Zealand Haka. It was bizarre. And I was like, that is a sign.
Right.
That is a sign. And I was just convinced that was my sign to really make a change in my life. So we had the best time at Glastonbury. I won't mention her name, but she's just so funny because you see this 60-plus-year-old woman and she's having a bit of a smoke. And I was like, what's going on here? You know, it was just like so surreal. And we met some guys and everyone. It was my first time at Glastonbury and we just had the best time. And I thought this, like, fun, this sense of aliveness, that's what I wanted to experience more of. And then I, obviously Glastonbury was over. I moved departments thinking, right, I'm not going to go back to covert intelligence. I'm going to go into another department, which was overt intelligence. And then first day in the office, there was a guy there that was nearing retirement. I think he had sort of like 356 days left to retirement. And he looked like a sack of crap. He didn't look great. He was just so unhealthy. And he was eating chocolate for breakfast, moaning about how many days he had left. And I thought, I don't want this to be my life. And I did 3 months. And I just had this, like, I just had this burning inkling. You've got to go. Your life in the police is dead now. You've got to go. And I remember waking up one morning. I thought, right, that's it. And I drove into work and I typed my resignation letter out. And I sent it to Force Wide, like people that I'd worked with, and my current inspector. I phoned up occupational health, HR, and said, how many days on your leave have I got left? 35. Right, book me 28 days because I'm not coming back tomorrow. And that was me, done.
Bye.
Inspector was like, you sure? You know, an hour and a half trying to convince me to stay. I was like, no, I'm gone. I had no idea. So the only thing I knew was because I'd already kind of had, like, I bought a property, done it up north of England as a buy-to-let investment, and I was in the process of buying another one. And I thought, well, if nothing else, I can do that. I mean, it's no, like, when you do a single buy-to-let, it's a couple hundred quid a month. It's not a great deal of money, but I just didn't care. I just knew that whatever I did, I'd make it work. And so when I walked out, it was November 2015, and it was just the best feeling. I felt a bit, do you know Bridget Jones's Diary, where she just walks out, she packs her bag, their box, and she just trots out of the office? That's how I felt. And yeah, it was just the best feeling. Just the best feeling. It like, it's walking into the unknown, but knowing everything's going to be okay. Or hoping it'd be okay.
Yeah, be healthier for it.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. And that was me. And then, so that was November. The 8th of December 2015 was my official retirement from the Force date. And then I was trying to find more properties to get to do up, and I bumped into a guy who had a portfolio of properties, but he said, gosh, you sound like you've been in sales for years. We've got this opportunity. Why don't you come and look at it? I'm like, what opportunity is that then? Commercial energy. And I was like, you what? Because energy is energy and gas and electric is gas and electric as far as I was concerned. But I didn't know there was a domestic and a commercial side of things. I didn't realise it's split into two. So I said, well, okay, I'll come and have a look at your opportunity. And I did. I went up to, I can't remember, it was Sheffield, I think it was, and spoke to the directors of this large company. It's like one of the largest in the UK, called Power Solutions. And what they're like a broker for agents to go out and procure energy contracts for businesses. And looked at the numbers. I thought, well, I can give this a go, you know. And the mantra was, and these are old guys that have been in sales. I've been in sales for 30 years. Earn as you learn. That was my sales training.
Do you know what? I was going to say it here regarding the change of industry. The old mantra, our industry in construction was always say yes and figure it out later.
Yeah.
Which is pretty much exactly the same thing, isn't it?
It is crap advice. I don't care what anybody says. It's crap. It's rubbish. because... You got to think, right? When you are trying to get a broker on board, they were like, right, you can be a broker, you can have your own area, West Midlands, you're trying to expand, grow a team, get these contracts, earn as you learn, and there's a bit of product knowledge. You're just kind of doing. So I did what came to me naturally, was talking to people, figuring out what the problems were. But they were really on a big push for, you got to show them this and you got to show them that, which is traditional sales training. And what happened was, so that was actually, again, end of January, I signed up to be a broker as part of this larger procurement company. And within the first 3 to 4 weeks, I'd landed a really massive contract. And it was more than what I projected to earn in a year. And then another two companies with five sites, so essentially five contracts. So I'd earned like over a year's worth of money in the space of 4 weeks. I was like, great, this is great. But then what happened is I tried to get into the product specs of thing, and I tried to be somebody that knew it all around the products. What I learned is that people aren't interested in that in sales. They don't care about your products or service. They care about how that product or service is going to help them solve the problem that they have. So is the electric or the gas that I'm selling to them, is it going to cost them less money than what they're paying now? And are they going to get enough of it to service their needs? That's all they're bothered about, you know? But when you're saying, well, we can do this and we can do that, and it's like, just glaze. So actually my sales declined. I got worse results. And then there was some things about the industry, you know, I was just like, what the hell is this? And that kind of leads me on to when you are running away from something. I was running away from the police and I was like, anything's got to be better. It's you have a different mindset to when you are running towards something, if that makes sense. So when you're consciously creating a life that you want, consciously creating the type of business that you want to have, it's very different to, I've got to get away from this thing. You know, it's very, very different energy. And I learned that. Took me a while to learn it, but I learned that.
Positive negative.
It's everything's a positive, because I think it's the only way you learn, isn't it? It's the only way you grow, is to learn from the negative.
All the lessons, aren't they?
Yeah, for sure. So the commercial energy lasted about a year and a half. It was the best and the worst time of my life, because, you know, I was earning good money for all the stress and the hours I was earning good money in the police, and there you kind of, you can't take a day sick. If you don't work, your business doesn't work. You get people, you're hiring and you're trying to manage that don't have the passion as you. You're the entrepreneur, you're the person, you're the business owner. They don't care half the time. They just want to earn a bit of money. And if they're not earning the money in the way that they want to earn that money, they're not doing the work in the way that you need them to do the work. So then your business doesn't grow. You become stressed. And so actually I was facing likely burnout again if I didn't do anything. I remember one day just like crying at the bottom of bed going, oh my God, oh, what have I done? But knowing there was something out there for me, you know, and one of the last straws, so I was about 5 months in, I went to a Federation of Small Businesses networking event at Drayton Manor. I thought, right, this is the last networking event I'm going to. I've had enough of this. In terms of the commercial energy. And the reason why I went was because there was this guy doing a talk about LinkedIn and how it had helped him in this really weird something about fabrication business, but LinkedIn had helped him to get ideal clients in a niche market. And I thought, I need to learn about that, but if this is no good, I'm out the door. And that guy was a guy called Tom Mallons. You may recognise the name. I'm now married to him. But he talked about that actually at our wedding. It's so funny because he did the talk and, you know, I just thought, one, I thought he was captivating because he's a great speaker. He's got great presence there. And he knew what he was talking about. You know, he'd built this business. But I thought, like, that could really help me. So he'd already released a book. So I said, oh, you want to take a selfie, the selfie with this book that he wrote? And he asked me out, and by sheer coincidence, we were parked next to each other in this massive car park, and he asked me out for a coffee, he asked me out for a drink, and I said, no, but I will have your course. It was the most expensive date, because I actually paid nearly $2,000 to do this bloody course with him on LinkedIn, but it changed my whole outlook, and it changed my business, it changed me, it changed the money that I was earning. And so Tom and I ended up dating after I did his course. It cost me $2,000, but earned me a load more. So it's a win-win there. And then, yeah, we sort of started to work together. He was doing this LinkedIn training. So we sort of changed the format of that a little bit. And then in our quest to sort of really understand how and why sales training isn't better than it was, or certainly that I'd received, started to do a bit of research, and we found this training organisation called Sandler Training, which is an American-owned sort of head franchise. They've got franchisees throughout the world. And we put ourselves through their training as clients, as a franchise in the heart of England, so sort of South Birmingham, which absolutely gave us a different outlook, because it wasn't just sales training, it was mindset and how you show up. And actually the difference between traditional sales people and sales pitches and a different way of thinking that's actually more consultative. And it's a win-win for both parties, because actually if you don't think your my product or service is right for you, then it's okay to not buy. Whereas you're not taught that in traditional sales. Right. It's like, give them all the product knowledge, make sure they get into an appointment, make sure they buy stuff, you know, and really forcing... Right. Yeah, and it's just...
That's, you know what, that brings me on to another point that I was going to talk to you about. So when I was looking into your history, I'd seen that there's a lot on mindset and a different way of selling. How do you find educating others? Like you say, there's your way, or there's a new way, the old way. How do you navigate teaching old dogs new tricks in regards ethics around selling and the culture of, like say, just get it done, get the numbers out the door? Because again, kind of in a similar vein to recruitment, selling as a stigma, salesperson on the phone. And again, like you say, all these TikTok billionaires, and it's sit there, there's your phone, don't move from there until don't take no.
Yeah.
Just go to the next part of the script, we never take no.
Yeah.
Now, how do you find training people, kind of re-educating people whose mindset has always been sell at any cost?
Yeah.
Kind of Wolf of Wall Street, isn't it?
It's yeah, the whole, it is. It is.
The whole, whole idea of just get them on the end of the phone. Once you're off the phone, they're done.
Yeah.
More for them, we've won, type thing.
Absolutely. So that's a really good question. So I'll put it back on you. How do you like to buy? Do you like somebody forcing you to buy, to book into appointments, even if you don't know what the hell they're talking about, but they're trying to get you into an appointment?
So what I find, which is... It's a good question, because we're in electrical contracting, so we use wholesalers.
Mm-hmm.
So these a wholesaler we've used, myself, my business partner, since I was an apprentice at the company we used to work for. And this guy's bounces around, as you do, in the industry. but we always use him wherever he goes. He drops back in, drops catalogue off, sets up an account, because we buy from him as a person. And in kind of contrast to that, these guys that are knocking on our door at the office, even though they've said, can we come and sit down with you? So look, at the moment, we're not really looking for anyone additionally, we've got enough. And then they'll come and knock on the door anyway. And I'll go to the door and I'll tell them, I said that we're not available at the moment, you know, we're busy. Don't really appreciate you coming unannounced. So I'm definitely of the side of dealing with people, buying from people. And I can't stomach that way of selling. I've got no time. If somebody tells you that they don't want to listen to you, buy from you at that point, because it's never, with us, it's never, don't call again. We just say, look, I'll be in touch when an opportunity comes up, when we get a job that, you know, we want an additional price for, I'll give you a shout. But that's never enough, is it? But again, I know from traditional sales techniques, they're told, aren't they, that that's not enough. No one would walk out. Chris said, no, thanks.
Yeah.
Now, what would be a traditional response to that from the sales manager to that person? Would it be, oh, okay, that's all right.
Or
would
it be soft objective? Objection, isn't it?
Yeah, pick some cakes up from Greg's and get round there.
Yeah.
But you're always told that people, you want to buy, you don't want to be sold to, don't you? People want to buy.
Yeah, for sure. And actually, there's a few valid points there, but first of all, do you know, as a salesperson, or do they know, that what they have is actually what you want and need? Because they've done no sort of fact-finding around if you're the decision-maker. So if you have a need for any of the solutions that they purport to offer, are you facing any of the challenges that they think they're going to solve with their products or service? So they haven't even asked any of those questions, because it might be that through all of that knocking on the door and trying to force, that you're not even the right person to speak to and don't have the problems that their you know, products or service can solve anyway. So the better way to approach that would be to have a real structured way of approaching somebody within a business and just say, look, this is who I typically work with. These are the maybe two or three challenges that I help them or that they face, how it makes them feel. Are they feeling frustrated that they're unable to find the right, conductor for their business? It causes them monetary problems in terms of, you know, the way or how much they sell. I don't know, phone off the top of my head. But they need to find out those answers first to really figure out if you're worth speaking to in 6 months' time or 3 months' time or however long, you know. And I think that's where traditional selling falls down, because you're just forced to sell the idea of the product or service rather than unpick the pain or potential pain that your ideal customer has, you know. And it's suspects and prospects, we call them. Suspect is just somebody, I mean, you see of LinkedIn connections, any one of those, if you pull them into your networks, you think, well, there might be an opportunity to sell to them, but you don't know until you've had that prospecting conversation. And that's where salespeople go wrong, because they're just kind of trying to force the thing down the throat, and it just doesn't work like that.
So where you talk there about LinkedIn as well. So I find, and I talk about this in the office, so if I connect with someone, and I know what I can see what they want to sell, but I like connecting with people, yeah, it's nice to talk to people. But then they've got an auto response on your accepting of their invitation, where straight away it's what they're trying to sell you. And straight away with that, you go, and you delete it, and then straight away in your mind, Rob, I don't want to talk to this guy now for a while. You know, I thought we were.
Yeah.
Kind of like the desperation of quick have this, rather than like you're saying, create a rapport or a dialogue around, you know, it's nice to connect with you.
Yeah.
And maybe if there's anything I can do to help you.
Yeah.
And then the idea is it that then posts, you see their posts, think, oh, actually, you say, we've done this for our client because they had this issue. Yeah. And then you see that, and it's a story more than just, do you want to buy this or do you want to buy anything, isn't it?
Yeah, for sure. You've been pitch slapped, we call it.
Is that what it is?
Yeah,
been pitch slapped. I get pitch slapped so many times.
I get pitch slapped. It's so rubbish. But that, that's where the mindset of the salesperson sort of falls down, because, you know, first of all, they're doing what they've been told to do or what they've just learned through seeing other people. You know, that's what I did at first. I was told to go out and just sell and
is that
show
still
me.
the old yeah. school way of selling, right?
Yeah.
Connect with them as soon as, if you can get him selling this or sending this.
Yeah. Well, half the people don't know. Half the sales managers and stuff, they have no clue. And, you know, I've worked for some, like a couple of big companies, and no matter how big they are, that a lot of the time they don't realise they're still operating in old ways, but they're trying to sell in a new world, and there's just such a disconnect, and then they wonder why their sales aren't as high as they once were, and they don't have any idea on how to social sell, what we call it, using LinkedIn, social media to sell in a way that's one to many, sell people on the idea first of all. And so then when you've got your salespeople, they're going out and they're just doing this stuff, they get really disheartened. They think that there's something wrong with them. And actually, it's just a role. You're just a salesperson. It doesn't define who you are as a person. And so it's like your identity and actually the role you play in life. So, you know, my identity is totally different to the role I play as a salesperson or a trainer or mentor or coach, you know. So, and that's where people like really fall down, especially in sales, because they think if they haven't sold something today, they're a really crap person or really crap this, or, you know,
that,
and it's, yeah. And that's where and it starts to fall into the psyche, as well as all of the, like, just think of the things when you grew up, don't talk to strangers. Well, how's that going to help you now as an adult trying to talk to strangers to potentially help them solve problems they're facing? So, it's a real, you're caught in a real trap and a real cycle if you don't find an alternative way of thinking about how you sell to people. And I'm so glad I found the training that I did, and all the other mindset stuff as well, because it gave me a totally different outlook on how to be a salesperson, a sales professional.
So in with a lot of the coaching, the mentoring, I've seen, obviously, you're expanded out, haven't you?
Mm.
You cover quite a large area. Are you into Europe and deal with countries other than the UK and companies?
Yeah, power of LinkedIn, that is, you know, because I've grown my network twice. So I grew my network to about 17,000 people. LinkedIn had a mad EP. I don't know what happened with it. Had a glitch. And it kind of froze my account. It just wouldn't show any of my content. And so I had to close that account down and start again. But when you are growing your network on LinkedIn, so for example, I connect with you, Chris, and then you're connected to Kev, then, but like for every one person you connect with, that one person's got around about 300 to 400 connections themselves. So actually my network is now not just one, it's 401, for, you know, and then that expands again, because then for every 400 people maybe you have, Kev, each person's got an average 400 people. So that's where, you know, opportunities from abroad have come to me, you know, from the USA, South Africa, Australia, and EU. I work for a Dutch company, and yeah, that's where the opportunity, so people are missing out on LinkedIn and the power of social selling and the power of social media by just not knowing what it can do for them. But as far as the mentoring goes, I just love that, because I've always done an element of training, coaching, mentoring from the police, you know, new recruits coming in, then new detectives. And it just makes, the type of person that I am, it just makes sense for me to be coaching people and mentoring them. You know, mentor is, I've been in that position, let me show you how you can avoid this and get to, you know, point A from B or B from A much quicker, in a much better way that's going to avoid this kind of stress or that kind of issue. So it comes very naturally to me, and I'm just very grateful that people want to work with me in that way.
Finally, last but not least, can we talk a little bit about your involvement with Suited for Success and Love Brum?
Yeah, for sure.
To charitable organisations.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, so Suited for Success is like it's an employability charity. So the CEO and founder, Patricia White, She used to work in the BBC, I don't know if you know that, but then she formed this charity to help people to get back into the world of work. So maybe they've been in the world of work, they've come out, maybe had children or, you know, sickness, whatever reason, that want to get back into employment, or they've never had any employment and they want to get into the world of work. So what she does is help with interview skills, CV writing, that kind of thing, and then dressing them suited for their interviews. So giving them a suite of clothes that they can go away and turn up to their interviews presentable. There's a big problem at the moment, of course, you know, with the cost of living crisis, and people are finding it difficult to pay their bus fare to get to interviews if it's in person, or, you know, afford good clothing to wear on top of their day-to-day spending. So it's a really great provision that they've got there. You know, I love working with Suited for Success. The team there are amazing. You know, Matthew does some great work with his styling. He used to work over in Savile Row. Okay. And but I've been doing sort of interview coaching is what I do. So people come on board, they're really nervous, want to sort of know what to say in interviews. So we'll talk them through like interview techniques and a bit of mindset. I've been doing more and more often, really, more and more often, because a lot of people have been out of the workplace for so long, they don't know what they're walking into. And so they start doubting themselves rather than the skills that they've got to offer. Yeah, and focusing on that. Yeah, exactly. So it's a whole different mindset, sort of coaching that we have to, that I'm finding myself doing now. And people have got more anxiety now because they've spent, you know, a few years practically behind closed doors with the pandemic. And it's just getting back out and...
Have you noticed that? Have you noticed?
Yeah.
Is it palpable?
Yeah, for sure. I had a bit of a time sort of coming out because I quite enjoyed my time behind the doors, I've got to say, with COVID. But I can adapt like that anyway. But for some people, it's just been so bad for them. You know, so bad that they've gone into disability now. They can't even work or don't feel that they can work. So, you know, I've been working with Suited for 2 years now. Gosh, yeah, 2 years. So, and, you know, it's so fulfilling. So fulfilling. I don't do as much as I'd like to, just because I tend to just like clock in once a month, go there, do a full day of coaching or mentoring, however many sessions that looks like, and really add value that way, because I've got obviously other commitments. But yeah, just absolutely love the work, you know, and the difference that Patricia and the team are making to people's lives by actually making them feel a worthwhile part of the workforce of the UK. It's just amazing.
Brilliant. You wouldn't even think it either. No. Really. You wouldn't even think of something like that that would help people, but it's such a valuable service.
Yeah, it is.
Oh,
it is.
Yeah. Without that kind of service, I mean, that's what Ash said in the previous podcast, wasn't it, when he worked for Department for Work and Pensions. Mm. He was working in town, working with the surrounding areas, and it was an eye-opener to him, the amount of people that had never worked.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I imagine taking someone trying to, I mean, even people that have been in out of jobs their entire career, yeah. CVs and interviews are daunting, aren't they? So
yeah.
I can only imagine what it's like for someone that's never...
Bananas.
And it's people that want to get into work though, but that this service then, like you say, you're coming in and saying, well, this is what to expect from the interview. Go in there with a certain amount of confidence, because I'm going to tell you what they're going to ask for, and you're going to be ready for that. You're going to look $1 million and you want the job.
Yeah.
So all three of them put together.
Yeah.
Go and get brilliant. It.
Could be Michael, brilliant. Right? It's literally the difference between gaining employment and not, isn't it?
Brilliant. Absolutely. And so she's just got the bus on the road, actually. So she's got an office in Hockley area-ish. Yeah. And and now she's had this big bus campaign, so they can actually take the services into the heart of the communities where people can't afford to, you know, pay the bus fare to get to the office. So it's brilliant. Sorry. Yeah.
And that then leads you into Loughborough, and made you aware of Loughborough, because you were aware of Loughborough from before?
So I was aware of Loughborough before, so I'd heard of Suited for Success, and it was always one of those things, oh, I must learn more about Loughborough, because obviously I saw PJ out and about, and I knew a tiny bit about him, knew a tiny bit about Tim Andrews, one of the other co-founders. And as I say, I was working for Suited for Success, found out actually that Suited was one of the first funded small causes by Loughborough, And then I just happened to see, that was it on LinkedIn, that there was a role for a new business development trustee. So I applied for that, had a meeting with Tim. And because new business and sales is my thing, I thought, yeah, actually, this is, I can just do this and really get stuck into something that I know and that I know can add value. And so I was getting married in the July. Then I started as a trustee in September. And then the head of operations left in mid-October. And I said, well, actually, I can do a bit of consulting for you. And yeah, and I've been there since really 1st of November. Bit of an about turn, which has been great. Just kind of building more value in to corporates and, you know, individual members. And 0121 got a membership package as well, just to help people understand what are they going to get from working with Lubbrum, who are they going to help? Because that, you know, it's a, if you're asking people to give money, that there's, I know it's a charity, but there's got to be some kind of value exchange.
Yeah.
You know, and so it's just really helping to nail what the value exchange is, so people do want to work with us and do want to invest. Because actually, by investing in Lubbrum, what a lot of people didn't realise is that they were helping so many causes. So it's highly leveraged charity to help to really tap into the community of Birmingham, where people are doing all this amazing work and nobody knows about it.
Yeah.
And they struggle to apply for funding.
Well, it's very important, yeah. Funding, yeah. And again, like you say, you need to be able to show the value, don't you? Especially in the current economic climate.
Yeah, for sure.
Say it's not enough, it's just like, can we have some money to help with this?
Exposure, yeah. Lubbrum are good at exposure, particularly PJ and Tim, who are big in the Birmingham community. Mm-hmm. They shout about it, and that's what's set them apart from other charities. But that's where obviously you and I met quite recently.
It feels like we've known each other. I know, fantastic. You are genuinely, you know, I'm blown away by your work.
Thank you. But the we were just discussing off camera that the Hidden Heroes campaign that's currently going on is that they're all interlinked, the charities, aren't they? So homeless in Birmingham, the prison guys for the support out of prison. I'm going to miss someone.
I've started listing them off.
Suits for Success.
Yeah.
Standing Tall.
Christy. Yeah. All of those.
And even to go to, they're all interlinked with, and she's going to kill me because I've forgotten her name, when they have... getting people back into work, into the warehouse and factory.
Better pathways, Nassim. Yeah.
Well, yeah, she'll kill me.
She won't.
They're all interlinked, but they're all affecting Birmingham as well. And to do something locally and concentrating locally is better than doing something nationally and not doing it properly. Yeah. So it's super important, obviously, for us growing up in Birmingham as well, and in the areas that we've grown up in, and there's still areas of Birmingham that are in trouble. So
there are
with Birmingham City, that's where they're aiming, in fact, at with their focus and concentration on charities. So it's super important, and it's super important to have you there to be able to. You've done the talk a couple of weeks.
Leadership Awards.
Yeah, the Leadership Awards. Mm. And as well as people, I feel people say, have you heard of Lubbrum? They're like, yeah, really. If you was to ask them, okay, so what is Lubbrum? They'd be like, oh, it's a Birmingham charity. And probably that's as far as it'll go.
Yeah.
Whereas you got up and spoke really well and told people this is what it is. And people are like, oh, and then they're raising an absolute fortune.
Yeah, they did.
In the auction stuff.
So grateful for, you know, people that want to raise money for Lubbrum. Mm. And so I guess, you know, we can start by saying, right, Lubbrum, because when I've spoken to people, what do you think Lubbrum does? They think we're a blog. They think we're some kind of magazine. They kind of think we're a charity, but they don't kind of get or know or understand what we do as part of that charity. So I guess, you know, I'll start by saying Lubbrum is a charity that supports, we find, fund and support smaller charities, smaller causes and CICs within the Birmingham postcode area. So that actually would sit outside some parts of Tamworth because, you know, some parts of Tamworth have a B postcode, but every B postcode area, we find, fund, support charities and people doing great work. So we've sort of funded over 200 causes over the last 9 years since it was founded in 2015. And, you know, but now we've had a real focus on the most pressing issues within the Birmingham area. So there's four issues: social justice, so anybody that feels that they're disadvantaged in any way or discriminated against, people in crisis, so people that have perhaps faced, you know, homelessness, mental health speaks for itself, and serious crime. Now, serious crime is, you know, it's not having a great time at the moment. It's just getting worse and worse, and we're actually very highly ranked within Europe for being top of the crime hotspot as an area. And, you know, we've realised that if we are helping these causes work within these areas, we have a much better opportunity and chance to support them in a more meaningful way. And so by focusing on those four areas, then we can really focus on the people doing work in those areas. So Birmingham Says No, for example, I don't know if you remember Benefit Street, the TV sort of reality show. Dee Kelly, she's one of the co-founders of Birmingham Says No, along with her partner, Rachel Warren. And they're doing great work trying to keep and steer youth away from knife and gun crime within the Birmingham area, doing some crazy work out there. They deliver workshops to, like bleed control workshops, to help their, you know, young people, to help their friends when they've been stabbed or shot. I mean, you know, to have to do that kind of work is just mind blowing.
You wouldn't think that would be something that they'd be addressing.
I know.
What we're tackling, it's bonkers.
Bananas. But they, because they are so small, and because they're not like, they're a CIC, so certain types of charities, they get access, better access to funding than others. And so, you know, Love Brum's a CIO, so we're a registered charity organisation. So we have to do everything like through Companies House, have financial records, etc. But some CICs don't. And so they don't qualify for some of the funding. So by people supporting Love Brum through memberships, corporate champions, 0121, individual memberships, and fundraising, you know, you sponsored runs, etc. When you support Love Brum, you're helping us to support our hidden heroes. And so this year we're highlighting nine causes in those four areas. And we're really giving them not just financial support, not a bit of money, our bab and off you go, but actually how do we help them grow as a charity? How do we help them to, because they're not business people, these are just good citizens that just want to do something good for their community and make it a better place to live. They're not business owners.
And so you have a structure and a framework.
Yeah, exactly. And that's where our corporates come in. And even our other members, you know, that's like, if you've got any skills that we can sort of matchmake, if you like, to our charities, to our causes, then by all means come on board, you know, and you pay a membership fee, but that membership fee, some of the funds go to the charities, but some of your skills go to the charities as well. Help them do more of the great work that they're doing. Help them to grow their charity so that they don't need Love Brum anymore.
Yeah.
Because that's my vision. I don't want a charity to be reliant on us as a charity for the end of time. I want them to be able to grow, be self-sustainable. That's what sales do. You know, it kind of links to the sales. In sales, you want to be self-sustainable, in my eyes. And so, you know, I would, to your listeners, I would say, look, if you want to learn more, come and speak to me, speak to you guys, put them in touch with me, because, you know, they're doing such, like, plausible work out there, just amazing work, you know. And if you go down and see, and you did the video, didn't you, for Malachi, saw his mural up, you know, Malachi runs Ambitious Lives, which is, he offers mentoring for SEN youth, so special educational needs youth, that have a problem going back into this mainstream schooling. Maybe they've got autism, severe anxiety. He told me some statistics the other week about the number of children that didn't go back to school after COVID. Something like 21% of kids didn't go back to school because of their, like, anxiety levels were elevated and all that stuff. And so he's, like, acting as a mentor and delivering these workshops to these kids that really need that support because, you know, we know what the council's like, what the situation they're in at the moment. And, you know, providing this support framework, the workshops, but he needs the money to be able to deliver those workshops.
Of course.
And he gets money through organisations like Love Brum at the moment, and people that want to fundraise or work directly with him in whatever the way that looks. But unless, you know, unless people help us, people like Malachi can't get access to funding. So that's my pitch.
No, it's, yeah.
Gives you money.
No, it is. Yeah. Good. And it's clear, because it's really sad that these issues exist, that someone needs to address it. But obviously it's really crucial and it's essential that people have put their head above the parapet, recognises the need for these services and put themselves forward to tackle them. So,
yeah,
fantastic cause. Well, thanks for your time today, Dion. A lot of great things covered. You've clearly had a very... very colourful life today. And do fantastic work for the charity. So, yeah, good luck with that.
Thank you
so much for your time.
No, thank you for inviting me on.
Thanks, Bob.
Thanks. Ta-ra, Babs.
Ta-ra, Bob.